searching his face.
You ain't got into nothing, is you?
You going to be sweet to me?
Oh, bigger.
Kiss me, honey. He felt her relax completely. He kissed her, and she drew him to the bed. They sat down. Gently, she took the money from his hand. How much is it? He asked.
Don't you know?
No.
Didn't you count it?
No.
Bigger, where you get this money from?
Maybe I'll tell you someday, he said, leaning back and resting his head on the pillow.
You into something.
How much is there?
$125.
You going to be sweet to me?
But Bigger, where you get this money from?
What do that matter?
You going to buy me something?
Sure.
What?
Anything you want. They were silent for a moment. Finally, his arm about her waist felt her body relax into a softness he knew and wanted. She rested her head on the pillow. He put the money in his pocket and leaned over her. Gee, honey, I've been wanting you bad.
For real?
Honest to God. He placed his hands on her breasts, just as he had placed them on Mary's last night, and he was thinking of that while he kissed her. He took his lips away for breath and heard Bessie say,
Don't stay away so long from me, here, honey.
I won't.
You love me?
Sure. He kissed her again, and he felt her arm lifting above his head, and he heard the click as the light went out. He kissed her again, hard. Bessie?
Huh?
Come on, honey. They were still a moment longer. Then she rose. He waited. He heard her clothes rustling in the darkness. She was undressing. He got up and began to undress. Gradually, he began to see in the darkness. She was on the other side of the bed, her dark body like a shadow in the denser darkness surrounding her. He heard the bed creak as she lay down. He went to her, folding her in his arms, mumbling. Gee, kid. He felt two soft palms holding his face tenderly, and the thought and image of the whole blind world which had made him ashamed and afraid fell away as he felt her as a fallow field beneath him stretching out under a cloudy sky waiting for rain. And he slept in her body, rising and sinking with the ebb and flow of her blood, being willingly dragged into a warm night sea to rise renewed to the surface to face a world he hated and wanted to blot out of existence, clinging close to a fountain whose warm waters washed and cleaned his senses, cooled them, made them strong and keen again, to see and smell and touch and taste and hear, cleared them to end the tiredness and to reforge in him a new sense of time and space. After he had been tossed to dry upon a warm sunlit rock under a white sky, he lifted his hand slowly and heavily and touched Bessie's lips with his fingers and mumbled, Gee, kid.
Bigger.
He took his hand away and relaxed. He did not feel that he wanted to step forth and resume where he had left off living. Not just yet. He was lying at the bottom of a deep, dark pit, upon a pallet of warm, wet straw, and at the top of the pit he could see the cold blue of the distant sky. Some hand had reached inside of him, and had laid a quiet finger of peace upon the restless tossing of his spirit, and had made him feel that he did not need to long for a home now. Then, like the long withdrawing sound of a receding wave, the sense of night and sea and warmth went from him, and he lay looking in the darkness at the shadowy outline of Bessie's body, hearing his and her breathing.
Bigger?
Huh?
You like your job?
Yeah. Why?
I just asked.
You swell.
You mean that?
Sure.
Where you working?
Over on Drexel.
Where?
In the 4600 block.
Oh.
What?
Nothing.
But what?
Oh, I just happened to think of something.
Tell me, what is it?
It ain't nothing bigger, honey.
What did she mean by asking all these questions? He wondered if she had detected anything in him. Then he wondered if he were not letting fear get the better of him by thinking always in terms of Mary and of her having been smothered and burnt. But he wanted to know why she had asked where he worked. Come on, honey. Tell me what you're thinking.
It ain't nothing much bigger. I used to work over in that section, not far from where the Loeb folks live.
Loeb?
Yeah. One of the families of one of the boys that killed that Franks boy, remember?
No, what you mean?
You remember hearing people talk about Loeb and Leopold?
Oh.
The ones who killed the boy and then tried to get money from the boy's family.
By sending notes to them, Bigger was not listening. The world of sound fell abruptly away from him, and a vast picture appeared before his eyes, a picture teeming with so much meaning that he could not react to it all at once. He lay, his eyes unblinking, his heart pounding, his lips slightly open, his breath coming and going so softly that it seemed he was not breathing at all.
You remember them, or you ain't even listening.
He said nothing.
How come you won't listen when I talk to you?
Why could he not send a letter to the Daltons asking for money?
Bigger.
He sat up in bed, staring into the darkness.
What's the matter, honey?
He could ask for 10,000, or maybe 20.
Bigger, what's the matter? I'm talking to you.
He did not answer. His nerves were taut with the hard effort to remember something. Now, yes, Loeb and Leopold had planned to have the father of the murdered boy get on a train and throw the money out of the window while passing some spot. He leaped from bed and stood in the middle of the floor.
Bigger?
He could, yes, he could have them pack the money in a shoebox and have them throw it out of a car somewhere on the south side. He looked round in the darkness, feeling Bessie's fingers on his arm. He came to himself and sighed.
What's the matter, honey?
She asked. Huh?
What's on your mind?
Nothing.
Come on and tell me. You worried?
No. No.
Now, I told you what was on my mind, but you won't tell me what's on yours. That ain't fair.
I just forgot something. That's all.
That ain't what you was thinking about,
she said. He sat back on the bed, feeling his scalp tingle with excitement. Could he do it? This was what had been missing, and this is what would make the thing complete. But this thing was so big he would have to take time and think it over carefully.
Honey, tell me where you get that money.
What money? He asked in a tone of feigned surprise.
Oh, Bigger, I know something's wrong. You worry. You got something on your mind. I can tell it.
You want me to make up something to tell you?
All right, if that's the way you feel about it.
Oh, Bessie.
You didn't have to come here tonight.
Maybe I shouldn't have come.
You don't have to come no more.
Don't you love me?
About as much as you love me.
How much is that?
You ought to know.
Oh, let's stop fussing, he said. He felt the bed sag gently and heard the bed covers rustling as she pulled them over her. He turned his head and stared at the dim whites of her eyes in the darkness. Maybe. Yes, maybe he could. Maybe he could use her. He leaned and stretched himself on the bed beside her. She did not move. He put his hand upon her shoulder, pressing it just softly enough to let her know that he was thinking about her. His mind tried to grasp and encompass as much of her life as it could, tried to understand and weigh it in relation to his own, as his hand rested on her shoulder. Could he trust her? How much could he tell her? Would she act with him blindly, believing his word?
"Come on. Let's get dressed and go out and get something to drink," she said.
"Okay."
"You ain't acting like you always act tonight."
"I got something on my mind."
"Can't you tell me?"
"I don't know."
"Don't you trust me?"
"Sure."
"Then why don't you tell me?"
He did not answer. Her voice had come in a whisper, a whisper he had heard many times when she wanted something badly. It brought to him a full sense of her life, what he had been thinking and feeling when he had placed his hand upon her shoulder. The same deep realization he had had that morning at home at the breakfast table while watching Vera and Buddy and his mother came back to him. Only it was Bessie he was looking at now, and seeing how blind she was. He felt the narrow orbit of her life. From her room to the kitchen of the white folks was the farthest she ever moved. She worked long hours, hard and hot hours, 7 days a week, with only Sunday afternoons off. And when she did get off, she wanted fun, hard and fast fun, something to make her feel that she was making up for the starved life she led. It was her hankering for sensation that he liked about her. Most nights, she was too tired to go out. She only wanted to get drunk. She wanted liquor, and he wanted her. So he would give her the liquor, and she would give him herself. He had heard her complain about how hard the white folks worked her. She had told him over and over again that she lived their lives when she was working in their homes, not her own. That was why, she told him, she drank. He knew why she liked him. He gave her money for drinks. He knew that if he did not give it to her, someone else would. She would see to that. Bessie, too, was very blind. What ought he tell her? She might come in just handy. Then he realized that whatever he chose to tell her ought not to be anything that would make her feel in any way out of it. She ought to be made to feel that she knew it all. God damn. He just simply could not get used to acting like he ought. He should not have made her think that something was happening, that he did not want her to know. "Give me time, honey, and I'll tell you," he said, trying to straighten things out.
"You don't have to unless you want to."
"Don't be that way."
"You just can't treat me any old way, beggar."
"I ain't trying to, honey."
"You can't play me cheap."
"Take it easy. I know what I'm doing."
"I hope you do."
"For Christ's sakes."
"Aw, come on. I want a drink."
"No. Listen."
"Keep your business. You don't have to tell me. But don't you come running to me when you need a friend, see?"
"When we get a couple of drinks, I'll tell you all about it."
"Suit yourself."
He saw her waiting at the door for him. He put on his coat and cap and they walked slowly down the stairs, saying nothing. It seemed warmer outside, as though it were going to snow again. The sky was low and dark. The wind blew. As he walked beside Bessie, his feet sank into the soft snow. The streets were empty and silent, stretching before him white and clean under the vanishing glow of a long string of street lamps. As he walked, he saw out of the corners of his eyes Bessie striding beside him, and it seemed that his mind could feel the soft swing of her body as it went forward. He yearned suddenly to be back in bed with her, feeling her body warm and pliant to his. But the look on her face was a hard and distant one. It separated him from her body by a great suggestion of space. He had not really wanted to go out with her tonight, but her questions and suspicions had made him say yes when she had wanted to go for a drink. As he walked beside her, he felt that there were two Bessies. One, a body that he had just had and wanted badly again. The other was in Bessie's face. It asked questions, it bargained, and sold the other Bessie to advantage. He wished he could clench his fist and swing his arm and blot out, kill, sweep away the Bessie on Bessie's face, and leave the other helpless and yielding before him. He would then gather her up and put her in his chest, his stomach, some place deep inside him, always keeping her there even when he slept, ate, talked, keeping her there just to feel and know that she was his to have and hold whenever he wanted to.
Where are we going?
Wherever you want to.
Let's go to the Paris Grill.
Okay. They turned a corner and walked to the middle of the block to the grill and went in. An automatic phonograph was playing. They went to a rear table. Bigger ordered two slow gin fizzes. They sat silent, looking at each other, waiting. He saw Bessie's shoulders jerking in rhythm to the music. Would she help him? Well, he would ask her. He would frame the story so that she would not have to know everything. He knew that he should have asked her to dance, but the excitement that had hold of him would not let him. He was feeling different tonight from every other night. He did not need to dance and sing and clown over the floor in order to blot out a day and night of doing nothing. He was full of excitement. The waitress brought the drinks, and Bessie lifted hers.
Here's to you, even if you don't want to talk, and even if you ears acting queer.
Bessie, I'm worried.
I'll come on and drink, she said.
Okay. They sipped.
Bigger?
Huh?
Can't I help you in what you're doing?
Maybe.
I want to.
You trust me?
I have so far.
I mean now.
Yes, if you tell me what to trust you for.
Maybe I can't do that.
Then you don't trust me.
It's got to be that way, Bessie.
If I trusted you, would you tell me?
Maybe.
Don't say maybe, Bigger.
Listen, honey, he said, not liking the way he was talking to her, but afraid of telling her outright. The reason I'm acting this way is I got something big on.
What?
It'll mean a lot of money.
I wish you'd either tell me or quit talking about it.
They were silent. He saw Bessie drain her glass.
I'm ready to go, she said.
Oh.
I want to get some sleep.
You mad?
Maybe.
He did not want her to be that way. How could he make her stay? How much could he tell her? Could he make her trust him without telling everything? He suddenly felt she would come closer to him if he made her feel that he was in danger. That's it. Make her feel concerned about him.
Maybe I'll have to go out of town soon, he said.
The police?
Maybe.
What you do?
I'm planning to do it now.
But where you get that money?
Look, Bessie, if I had to leave town and wanted dough, would you help me if I split with you?
If you took me with you, you wouldn't have to split.
He was silent. He had not thought of Bessie's being with him. A woman was a dangerous burden when a man was running away. He had read of how men had been caught because of women, and he did not want that to happen to him. But if he told her, yes, just enough to get her to work with him. Okay, he said, I'll say this much. I'll take you if you help me.
You really mean that?
Sure.
Then you're going to tell me?
Yes. He could dress the story up. Why even mention Jan? Why not tell her so that if she were ever questioned, she would say the things that he wanted her to say, things that would help him? He lifted the glass and drained the liquor and set it down and leaned forward and toyed with the cigarette in his fingers. He spoke with bated breath. Listen, here's the dope, see? The gal where I'm working, the daughter of the old man who's rich and millionaire, has done run off with a red, see?
Eloped?
Yeah. Eloped.
With a red?
Yeah, one of them communists.
Oh, what's wrong with her?
Oh, she's crazy. Nobody don't know she's gone, so last night I took the money from her room, see?
Oh.
They don't know where she is.
But what you going to do?
They don't know where she is, he said again.
What you mean?
He sucked his cigarette. He saw her looking at him, her black eyes wide with eager interest. He liked that look. In one way, he hated to tell her, because he wanted to keep her guessing. He wanted to take as long as possible in order to see that look of complete absorption upon her face. It made him feel alive and gave him a heightened sense of the value of himself. I got an idea, he said.
Oh, Bigger, tell me.
Don't talk so loud.
Well, tell me.
They don't know where the girl is. They might think she's kidnapped, see? His whole body was tense, and as he spoke, his lips trembled.
Oh, that was what you were so excited about when I told you about Loeb and Leopold.
Well, what you think?
Would they really think she's kidnapped?
We can make them think it. She looked into her empty glass. Bigger beckoned the waitress and ordered two more drinks. He took a deep swallow and said, The gal's gone, see? They don't know where she is. Don't nobody know. But they might think somebody did if they was told, see?
You mean we could say we did it? You mean write to him?
And ask for money, sure, he said. And get it, too. You see, we cash in, because nobody else is trying to.
But suppose she shows up?
She won't.
How you know?
I just know she won't.
Bigger, you know something about that girl. You know where she is?
That's all right about where she is. I know we won't have to worry about her showing up, see?
Oh, Bigger, this is crazy.
Then hell, we won't talk about it no more.
Oh, I don't mean that.
Then what do you mean?
I mean we got to be careful.
We can get $10,000.
How?
We can have them leave the money somewhere. They'll think they can get the girl back.
Bigger, you know where that girl is,
she said, giving her voice a tone of half question and half statement. No.
Then it'll be in the papers. She'll show up.
She won't.
How you know?
She just won't. He saw her lips moving, then heard her speak softly, leaning toward him.
Bigger. You ain't done nothing to that girl, is you?
He stiffened with fear. He felt suddenly that he wanted something in his hand, something solid and heavy. His gun, a knife, a brick. If you say that again, I'll slap you back from this table.
Oh!
Come on now, don't be a fool.
Bigger, you oughtn't have done it.
You going to help me?
Say yes or no.
Gee, Bigger.
You scared? You scared after letting me take that silver from Miss Hurd's home? After letting me get Mrs. Macy's radio, you scared now?
I don't know.
You wanted me to tell you. Well, I told you. That's a woman always. You want to know something, then you run like a rabbit.
But we'll get caught.
Not if we do right.
But how could we do it, Bigger?
I'll figure it out.
But I want to know.
It'll be easy.
But how?
I can fix it so you can pick up the money and nobody will bother you.
They catch people who do things like that.
If you're scared, they will catch you.
How could I pick up the money?
We'll tell them where to leave it.
But they'll have police watching.
Not if they want the gal back. We got a club over them, see? And I'll be watching, too. I work in the house where they live. If they try to double-cross us, I'll let you know.
You reckon we could do it?
We could have them throw the money out of a car. You could be in some spot to see if they send anybody to watch. If you see anybody around, then you don't touch the money, see? But they want the gal. They won't watch. There was a long silence.
Bigger, I don't know, she said.
We could go to New York, to Harlem if we had money. New York's a real town. We could lay low for a while.
But suppose they mark the money.
They won't. And if they do, I'll tell you. You see, I'm right there in the house.
But if we run off, they'll think we did it. They'll be looking for us for years, Bigger.
We won't run right away. We'll lay low for a while.
I don't know, Bigger.
He felt satisfied. He could tell by the way she looked that if he pushed her hard enough, she would come in with him. She was afraid, and he could handle her through her fear. He looked at his watch. It was getting late. He ought to go back and have a look at that furnace. Listen, I got to go. He paid the waitress and they went out. There was another way to bind her to him. He drew forth the roll of bills, peeled off one for himself, and held out the rest of the money toward her. Here, he said. Get you something and save the rest for me.
Oh!
She looked at the money and hesitated. Don't you want it?
Yeah,
she said, taking the roll. If you string along with me, you get plenty more. They stopped in front of her door. He stood looking at her. Well, he said, what you think?
Bigger, honey, I don't know,
she said plaintively. You wanted me to tell you.
I'm scared.
Don't you trust me?
But we ain't never done nothing like this before. They'll look everywhere for us for something like this. It ain't like coming to where I work at night when the white folks is gone out of town and stealing something. It ain't.
It's up to you.
I'm scared, Bigger.
Who on earth will think we did it?
I don't know. You really think they don't know where the girl is?
I know they don't.
You know.
No.
She'll turn up.
She won't. And anyhow, she's a crazy girl. They might even think she's in it herself just to get money from a family. They might think the Reds is doing it. They won't think we did it. They don't think we got enough guts to do it. They think niggas is too scared.
I don't know.
Did I ever tell you wrong?
No, but we ain't never done nothing like this before.
Well, I ain't wrong now.
When do you want to do it?
Soon as they begin to worry about the gal.
You really reckon we could?
I told you what I think.
No, bigger. I ain't gonna do it. I think you...
He turned abruptly and walked away from her.
Bigger?
She ran over the snow and tugged at his sleeve. He stopped but did not turn round. She caught his coat and pulled him about. Under the yellow sheen of a street lamp, they confronted each other, silently. All about them was the white snow in the night. They were cut off from the world and were conscious only of each other. He looked at her without expression, waiting. Her eyes were fastened fearfully and distrustfully upon his face. He held his body in an attitude that suggested that he was delicately balanced upon a hairline, waiting to see if she would push him forward or draw him back. Her lips smiled faintly, and she lifted her hand and touched his face with her fingers. He knew that she was fighting out in her feelings the question of just how much he meant to her. She grabbed his hand and squeezed it, telling him in the pressure of her fingers that she wanted him.
But bigger, honey, let's don't do that. We getting along all right, like we is now.
He drew his hand away. I'm going, he said.
When I see you, honey?
I don't know. He started off again, and she overtook him and encircled him with her arms.
Bigger, honey.
Come on, Bessie. What you going to do?
She looked at him with round, helpless black eyes. He was still poised, wondering if she would pull him toward her or let him fall alone. He was enjoying her agony, seeing and feeling the worth of himself in her bewildered desperation. Her lips trembled, and she began to cry.
What you going to do? He asked again.
If I do it, it's 'cause you want me to, she sobbed.
He put his arm about her shoulders.
Come on, Bessie, he said. Don't cry.
She stopped and dried her eyes. He looked at her closely.
She'll do it, he thought. I got to go, he said.
I ain't going in right now.
Where you going?
He found that he was afraid of what she did, now that she was working with him. His peace of mind depended upon knowing what she did and why.
I'm going to get a pint.
That was all right.
She was feeling as he knew she always felt.
Well, I see you tomorrow night, huh?
Okay, honey, but be careful.
Look, Bessie, don't you worry none. Just trust me. No matter what happens, they won't catch us. They won't even know you had anything to do with it.
If they start after us, where could we hide, bigger? You know we's black. We can't just go anywhere.
He looked round the lamplit, snow-covered street. There's plenty of places, he said. I know the South Side from A to Z. We could even hide out in one of those old buildings, see? Like I did last time. Nobody ever looks into them. He pointed across the street to a black, looming, empty apartment building.
Well,
she sighed.
I'm going, he said.
So long, honey.
He walked toward the car line. When he looked back, he saw her still standing in the snow. She had not moved.
She'll be all right, he thought. She'll go along.
Snow was falling again. The streets were long paths leading through a dense jungle, lit here and there with torches held high in invisible hands. He waited 10 minutes for a car, and none came. He turned the corner and walked, his head down, his hands dug into his pockets, going to Dalton's. He was confident. During the last day and night, new fears had come, but new feelings had helped to allay those fears.
The moment when he had stood above Mary's bed and found that she was dead, the fear of electrocution had entered his flesh and blood. But at home, at the breakfast table with his mother and sister and brother, seeing how blind they were, and overhearing Peggy and Mrs. Dalton talking in the kitchen, a new feeling had been born in him, a feeling that all but blotted out the fear of death. As long as he moved carefully and knew what he was about, he could handle things, he thought. As long as he could take his life into his own hands and dispose of it as he pleased, as long as he could decide just when and where he would run to, he need not be afraid. He felt that he had his destiny in his grasp. He was more alive than he could ever remember having been. His mind and attention were pointed, focused toward a goal. For the first time in his life, he moved consciously between two sharply defined poles. He was moving away from the threatening penalty of death, from the death-like times that brought him that tightness and hotness in his chest. And he was moving toward that sense of fullness he had so often but inadequately felt in magazines and movies. The shame and fear and hate, which Mary and Jan and Mr. Dalton and that huge rich house had made rise so hard and hot in him, had now cooled and softened. Had he not done what they thought he never could, his being black and at the bottom of the world was something which he could take with a newborn strength. What his knife and gun had once meant to him, his knowledge of having secretly murdered Mary now meant. No matter how they laughed at him for his being black and clown-like, he could look them in the eyes and not feel angry. The feeling of being always enclosed in the stifling embrace of an invisible force had gone from him. As he turned into Drexel Boulevard and headed toward Dalton's, he thought of how restless he had been, how he was consumed always with a body hunger. Well, in a way, he had settled that tonight. As time passed, he would make it more definite. His body felt free and easy now that he had lain with Bessie. That she would do what he wanted was what he had sealed in asking her to work with him in this thing. She would be bound to him by ties deeper than marriage. She would be his. Her fear of capture and death would bind her to him with all the strength of her life, even as what he had done last night had bound him to this new path with all the strength of his own life. He turned off the sidewalk and walked up the Dalton driveway, went into the basement, and looked through the bright cracks of the furnace door. He saw a red heap of seething coals and heard the upward hum of the draft. He pulled the lever, hearing the rattle of coal against tin and seeing the quivering embers grow black. He shut off the coal and stooped and opened the bottom door of the furnace. Ashes were piling up. He would have to take the shovel and clean them out in the morning and make sure that no unburnt bones were left. He had closed the door and started to the rear of the furnace, going to his room, when he heard Peggy's voice.
Bigger!
He stopped, and before answering, he felt a keen sensation of excitement flush all over his skin. She was standing at the head of the stairs, in the door leading to the kitchen. Yes'm? He went to the bottom of the steps and looked upward.
Mrs. Dalton wants you to pick up the trunk at the station.
The trunk? He waited for Peggy to answer his surprised question. Perhaps he should not have asked it in that way.
They called up and said that no one had claimed it, and Mr. Dalton got a wire from Detroit. Mary never got there.
Yes'm. She came all the way down the stairs and looked round the basement, as though seeking some missing detail. He stiffened. If she saw something that would make her ask him about Mary, he would take the iron shovel and let her have it straight across her head, and then take the car and make a quick getaway.
Mr. Dalton's worried, Peggy said. You know, Mary didn't pack the new clothes she bought to take with her on the trip, and poor Mrs. Dalton's been pacing the floor and phoning Mary's friends all day.
Don't nobody know where she is? Bigger asked.
Nobody. Did Mary tell you to take the trunk like it was?
Yes'm, he said, knowing that this was the first hard hurdle. It was locked and standing in a corner. I took it down and put it right where you saw it this morning.
Oh, Peggy!
Mrs. Dalton's voice called.
Yes,
Peggy answered. Bigger looked up and saw Mrs. Dalton at the head of the stairs, standing in white as usual, and with her face tilted trustingly upward.
Is the boy back yet?
He's down here now, Mrs. Dalton.
Come in the kitchen a moment, will you, Bigger?
She asked. Yes'm. He followed Peggy into the kitchen. Mrs. Dalton had her hands clasped tightly in front of her, and her face was still tilted, higher now, and her white lips were parted.
Peggy told you about picking up the trunk?
Yes'm. I'm on my way now.
What time did you leave here last night?
A little before 2, ma'am.
And she told you to take the trunk down?
Yes'm.
And she told you not to put the car up?
Yes'm.
And it was just where you left it last night when you came this morning?
Yes'm. Mrs. Dalton turned her head as she heard the inner kitchen door open. Mr. Dalton stood in the doorway. Hello, Bigger.
Good day, sir.
How are things?
Fine, sir.
The station called about the trunk a little while ago. You'll have to pick it up.
Yes, sir. I'm on my way now, sir.
Listen, Bigger. What happened last night?
Well, nothing, sir. Miss Dalton told me to take the trunk down so I could take it to the station this morning. And I did.
Was Jan with you?
Yes, sir. All three of us went upstairs when I brought him in the car. We went to the room to get the trunk. Then I took it down and put it in the basement.
Was Jan drunk?
Well, I don't know, sir. They was drinking.
And what happened?
Nothing, sir. I just took the trunk to the basement and left. Miss Dalton told me to leave the car out. She said Mr. Jam would take care of it.
What were they talking about? Bigger hung his head.
I don't know, sir.
He saw Mrs. Dalton lift her right hand, and he knew that she meant for Mr. Dalton to stop questioning him so closely. He felt her shame.
That's all right, Bigger,
Mrs. Dalton said. She turned to Mr. Dalton.
Where do you suppose this Jan would be now?
Maybe he's at the Labor Defender office.
Can you get in touch with him?
Well, said Mr. Dalton, standing near Bigger and looking hard at the floor. I could, but I'd rather wait. I still think Mary's up to some of her foolish pranks. Bigger, you'd better get that trunk.
Yes, sir.
He got the car and drove through the falling snow toward the loop. In answering their questions, he felt that he had succeeded in turning their minds definitely in the direction of Jan. If things went at this pace, he would have to send the ransom note right away. He would see Bessie tomorrow and get things settled. Yes. He would ask for $10,000. He would have Bessie stand at the window of an old building at some well-lighted street corner with a flashlight. In the note, he would tell Mr. Dalton to put the money in a shoebox and drop it in the snow at the curb. He would tell him to keep his car moving and his lights blinking, and not to drop the money until he saw the flashlight blink 3 times in the window. Yes, that's how it would be. Bessie would see the lights of Mr. Dalton's car blinking, and after the car was gone, she would pick up the box of money. It would be easy. He pulled the car into the station, presented the ticket, got the trunk, hoisted it to the running board, and headed again for the Dalton home. When he reached the driveway, the snow was falling so thickly
that he could not see 10 feet in front of him. He put the car into the garage, set the trunk in the snow, locked the garage door, lifted the trunk to his back, and carried it to the entrance of the basement. Yes, the trunk was light. It was half empty. No doubt they would question him again about that. Next time he would have to go into details, and he would try to fasten hard in his mind the words he spoke, so that he could repeat them 1,000 times if necessary. He could, of course, set the trunk in the snow right now and take a streetcar and get the money from Bessie and leave town. But why do that? He could handle this thing. It was going his way. They were not suspecting him, and he would be able to tell the moment their minds turned in his direction. And two, he was glad he had let Bessie keep that money. Suppose he were searched here on the job. For them to find money on him was alone enough to fasten suspicion upon him definitely. He unlocked the door and took the trunk inside. His back was bent beneath its weight, and he walked slowly with his eyes on the wavering red shadows on the floor. He heard the fires singing in the furnace. He took the trunk to the corner in which he had placed it the night before. He put it down and stood looking at it. He had an impulse to open it and look inside. He stooped to fumble with the metal clasp, then started violently, jerking upright. Vigor? Without answering, and before he realized what he was doing, he whirled, his eyes wide with fear, and his hand half raised as though to ward off a blow. The moment of whirling brought him face to face with what seemed to his excited senses an army of white men. His breath stopped, and he blinked his eyes in the red darkness, thinking that he should be acting more calmly. Then he saw Mr. Dalton and another white man standing at the far end of the basement. In the red shadows, their faces were white disks of danger, floating still in the air. "Oh," he said softly. The white man at Mr. Dalton's side was squinting at him. He felt that tight, hot, choking fear returning. The white man clicked on the light. He had a cold, impersonal manner that told Bigger to be on his guard. In the very look of the man's eyes, Bigger saw his own personality reflected in narrow, restricted terms.
"What's the matter, boy?" the man asked.
Bigger said nothing. He swallowed, caught hold of himself, and came forward slowly. The white man's eyes were steadily upon him. Panic seized Bigger as he saw the white man lower his head, narrow his eyes still more, sweep back his coat and ram his hands into his pants pockets, revealing as he did so a shining badge on his chest. Words rang in Bigger's mind. "This is a cop." He could not take his eyes off the shining bit of metal. Abruptly, the man changed his attitude and expression, took his hands from his pocket, and smiled a smile that Bigger did not believe.
"I'm not the law, boy, so don't be scared."
Bigger clamped his teeth. He had to control himself. He should not have let that man see him staring at his badge.
"Yes, sir," he said.
"Bigger, this is Mr. Britton," Mr. Dalton said. "He's a private investigator attached to the staff of my office."
"Yes, sir,"
Bigger said again, his tension slackening.
"He wants to ask you some questions, so just be calm and try to tell him whatever he wants to know."
"Yes, sir."
This ends Disc 5. Native Son, Disc 6.
"First of all, I want to have a look at that trunk," Britton said.
Bigger stood aside as they passed him. He glanced quickly at the furnace. It was still very hot, droning. Then he, too, went to the trunk, standing discreetly to one side, away from the two white men, looking with surface eyes at what they were doing.
He shoved his hands deep into his pockets. He stood in a peculiar attitude that allowed him to respond at once to whatever they said or did, and at the same time to be outside and away from them. He watched Britton turn the trunk over and bend to it and try to work the lock.
I got to be careful, Bigger thought. One little slip now, and I'll spoil the whole thing.
Sweat came onto his neck and face. Britton could not unlock the trunk, and he looked upward at Bigger.
It's locked. You got a key, boy?
No, sir.
Bigger wondered if this were a trap. He decided to play safe and speak only when he was spoken to.
You mind if I break it?
Go right ahead, Mr. Dalton said. Say, Bigger, get Mr. Britton the hatchet.
Yes, sir,
he answered mechanically. He thought rapidly, his entire body stiff. Should he tell them that the hatchet was somewhere in the house, and offer to go after it and take the opportunity and run away? How much did they really suspect him? Was this whole thing a ruse to confuse and trap him? He glanced sharply and intently at their faces. They seemed to be waiting only for the hatchet. Yes, he would take a chance and stay. He would lie his way out of this. He turned and went to the spot where the hatchet had been last night, the spot from which he had taken it to cut off Mary's head. He stopped and pretended to search. Then he straightened.
It ain't here now. I saw it about here yesterday, he mumbled.
Well, never mind, Britton said. I think I can manage.
Bigger eased back toward them, waiting, watching. Britton lifted his foot and gave the lock a short, stout kick with the heel of his shoe, and it sprang open. He lifted out the tray and looked inside. It was half empty, and the clothes were disarrayed and tumbled. You see? Mr. Dalton said. She didn't take all of her things.
Yes. In fact, she didn't need a trunk at all from the looks of this, Britton said.
Bigger, was the trunk locked when she told you to take it down? Mr. Dalton asked.
Yes, sir, Bigger said, wondering if that answer was the safest.
Was she too drunk to know what she was doing, Bigger?
Well, they went into the room, he said. I went in after them. Then she told me to take the trunk down. That's all happened.
She could have put these things into a small suitcase, Britton said.
The fires sang in Bigger's ears, and he saw the red shadows dance on the walls. Let them try to find out who did it. His teeth were clamped hard until they ached.
Sit down, Bigger, Britton said.
Bigger looked at Britton, feigning surprise.
Sit on the trunk, Britton said.
Me?
Yeah, sit down.
He sat.
Now, take your time and think hard. I want to ask you some questions.
Yes, sir.
What time did you take Miss Dalton from here last night?
About 8:30, sir.
Bigger knew that this was it. This man was here to find out everything. This was an examination. He would have to point his answers away from himself quite definitely. He would have to tell his story. He would let each of the facts of his story fall slowly, as though he did not realize the significance of them. He would answer only what he was asked.
You drove her to school?
He hung his head and did not answer.
Come on, boy.
Well, mister, you see, I'm just working here.
What do you mean?
Mr. Dalton came close and looked hard into his face.
Answer his questions, Bigger.
Yes, sir.
You drove her to school?
Britton asked again. Still, he did not answer.
I asked you a question, boy.
No, sir. I didn't drive her to school.
Where did you take her?
Well, sir, she told me, after I got as far as the park, to turn round and take her to the loop.
She didn't go to school?
Mr. Dalton asked, his lips hanging open in surprise.
No, sir.
Why didn't you tell me this before, Bigger?
She told me not to.
There was silence. The furnace droned. Huge red shadows swam across the walls.
Where did you take her, then?
Britton asked.
To the loop, sir.
Whereabouts in the loop?
To Lake Street, sir.
Do you remember the number?
16, I think, sir.
16 Lake Street?
Yes, sir.
That's the Labor Defender Office, Mr. Dalton said, turning to Britton. This Jan's a red.
How long was she in there?
Britton asked.
About half an hour, I reckon, sir.
Then what happened?
Well, I waited in the car.
She stayed there till you brought her home?
No, sir.
She came out?
They came out.
This man, Jan, was with her then?
Yes, sir. He was with her. Seems to me she went in there to get him. She didn't say anything. She just went in and stayed a while and then came out with him.
Then you drove him?
He drove, Bigger said.
Weren't you driving?
Yes, sir. But he wanted to drive, and she told me to let him. There was another silence. They wanted him to draw the picture, and he would draw it like he wanted it. He was trembling with excitement. In the past, had they not always drawn the picture for him? He could tell them anything he wanted, and what could they do about it? It was his word against Jan's, and Jan was a red.
You waited somewhere for him? Britton asked.
The tone of curt hostility had suddenly left his voice.
No, sir. I was in the car.
And where did they go?
He wanted to tell how they had made him sit between them. But he thought that he would tell that later on, when he was telling how Jan and Mary had made him feel.
Well, Mr. Jan asked me where was a good place to eat. The only one I knew about were white folks. He said, white folks, very slowly, so that they would know that he was conscious of what was meant. It on the south side was Ernie's kitchen shack.
You took them there?
Mr. Jan drove the car, sir.
How long did they stay there?
Well, we must have stayed.
Weren't you waiting in the car?
No, sir. You see, mister, I did what they told me. I was only working for them.
Oh, Britton said. I suppose he made you eat with him.
I didn't want to, mister. I swear I didn't. He kept worrying me till I went in.
Britton walked away from the trunk, running the fingers of his left hand nervously through his hair. Again, he turned to Bigger.
They got drunk, huh?
Yes, sir. They was drinking.
What did this Jan say to you?
He talked about the communists.
How much did they drink?
It seemed like a lot to me, sir.
Then you brought him home?
I drove him through the park, sir.
Then you brought him home?
Yes, sir. That was nearly two.
How drunk was Miss Dalton?
Well, she couldn't hardly stand up, sir. When we got home, he had to lift her up the steps, Bigger said with lowered eyes.
That's all right, boy. You can talk to us about it, Britton said. Just how drunk was she?
She passed out, Bigger said. Britton looked at Dalton.
She could not have left this house by herself, Britton said. If Mrs. Dalton's right, then she could not have left.
Britton stared at Bigger, and Bigger felt that some deeper question was on Britton's mind.
What else happened?
He would shoot now. He would let them have some of it.
Well, I told you Miss Dalton told me to take the trunk. I said that 'cause she told me not to tell about me taking it to the loop. It was Mr. Jan who told me to take the trunk down and not put the car away.
He told you not to put the car away and to take the trunk?
Yes, sir. That's right.
Why didn't you tell us this before, Bigger? Asked Mr. Dalton.
She told me not to, sir.
How was this Jan acting? Britton said.
He was drunk, said Bigger, feeling that now was the time to drag Jan in definitely. Mr. Jan was the one who told me to take the trunk down and leave the car in the snow. I told you Miss Dalton told me that, but he told me. I would have been giving the whole thing away if I had told about Mr. Jan.
Britton walked toward the furnace and back again. The furnace droned as before. Bigger hoped that no one would try to look into it now. His throat grew dry. Then he started nervously as Britton whirled and pointed his finger into his face.
What did he say about the party?
Sir?
Oh, come on, boy, don't stall. Tell me what he said about the party.
The party? He asked me to sit at his table.
I mean the party.
It wasn't a party, mister. He made me sit at his table, and he bought chicken and told me to eat. I didn't want to, but he made me, and it was my job.
Britton came closer to Bigger and narrowed his gray eyes.
What unit are you in?
Sir?
Come on, comrade. Tell me what unit you're in.
Bigger gazed at him, speechless, alarmed.
Who's your organizer?
I don't know what you mean, Bigger said, his voice quavering.
Don't you read the Daily?
Daily what?
Didn't you know Jan before you came to work here?
No, sir. No, sir.
Didn't they send you to Russia?
Bigger stared and did not answer. He knew now that Britton was trying to find out if he were a communist. It was something he had not counted on, ever. He stood up, trembling. He had not thought that this thing could cut two ways. Slowly, he shook his head and backed away.
No, sir. You got me wrong. I ain't never fooled around with them folks. Miss Dalton and Mr. Jan was the first ones I ever met, so help me God.
Britton followed Bigger till Bigger's head struck the wall. Bigger looked squarely into his eyes. Britton, with a movement so fast that Bigger did not see it, grabbed him in the collar and rammed his head hard against the wall. He saw a flash of red.
You are a communist, you goddamn black son of a bitch! And you're going to tell me about Miss Dalton and that Jan bastard?
No, sir. I ain't no communist. No, sir.
Well, what's this?
Britton jerked from his pocket the small packet of pamphlets that Bigger had put in his dresser drawer and held them under his eyes.
You know you're lying. Come on, talk.
No, sir. You got me wrong. Mr. Jan gave me them things. He and Miss Dalton told me to read them.
Didn't you know Miss Dalton before?
No, sir.
Wait, Britton.
Mr. Dalton laid his hand on Britton's arm.
Wait.
There's something to what he says. She tried to talk to him about unions when she first saw him yesterday. If that Jan gave him those pamphlets,
then he knows nothing about it. You're sure?
I'm positive. I thought at first, when you brought me those pamphlets, that he must have known something, but I don't think he does. And there's no use blaming him for something he didn't do.
Britton loosened his fingers from Bigger's collar and shrugged his shoulders. Bigger relaxed, still standing, his head resting against the wall, aching. He had not thought that anyone would dare think that he, a black Negro, would be Jan's partner. Britton was his enemy. He knew that the hard light in Britton's eyes held him guilty because he was black. He hated Britton so hard and hot, while standing there with sleepy eyes and parted lips, that he would gladly have grabbed the iron shovel from the corner and split his skull in two. For a split second, a roaring noise in his ears blotted out sound. He struggled to control himself. Then he heard Britton talking.
Got to get hold of that Jan.
That seems to be the next thing, said Mr. Dalton, sighing. Bigger felt that if he said something directly to Mr. Dalton, he could swing things round again in his favor, but he did not know just how to put it.
You suppose she ran off? He heard Britton ask.
I don't know, Mr. Dalton said.
Britton turned to Bigger and looked at him. Bigger kept his eyes down.
Boy, I just want to know. Are you telling the truth?
Yes, sir. I'm telling the truth. I just started to work here last night. I ain't done nothing. I did just what they told me to do.
You sure he's all right? Britton asked Dalton.
He's all right. If you don't want me to work for you, Mr. Dalton, Bigger said, I'll go home. I didn't want to come here, he continued, feeling that his words would awaken in Mr. Dalton a sense of why he was here. But they sent me anyhow.
That's true, Mr. Dalton told Britton.
He's referred to me from the relief. He's been in a reform school, and I'm giving him a chance.
Mr. Dalton turned to Bigger.
Just forget it, Bigger. We had to make sure. Stay on and do your work. I'm sorry this had to happen. Don't let it break you down.
Yes, sir.
Okay, said Britton. If you say he's okay, then it's okay with me.
Go on to your room, Bigger, said Mr. Dalton.
Yes, sir.
Head down, he walked to the rear of the furnace and upstairs to his room. He turned the latch on the door and hurried to the closet to listen. The voices came clearly. Britton and Mr. Dalton had come into the kitchen.
My, but it was hot down there, said Mr. Dalton.
Yes.
I'm a little sorry you bothered him. He's here to try to get a new slant on things.
Well, you see him one way and I see him another. To me, a nigger's a nigger.
But he's sort of a problem boy. He's not really bad.
You got to be rough with him, Dalton. See how I got that dope out of him? He wouldn't have told you that.
But I don't want to make a mistake here. It wasn't his fault. He was doing what that crazy daughter of mine told him. I don't want to do anything I'll regret. After all, these black boys never get a chance.
They don't need a chance, if you ask me. They get in enough trouble without it.
Well, as long as they do their work, let's let them be.
Just as you say. You want me to stay on the job?
Sure. We must see this Jan. I can't understand Mary's going away and not saying anything.
I can have him picked up.
No, not that way. Those Reds'll get hold of it and they'll raise a stink in the papers.
Well, what do you want me to do?
I'll try to get him to come here. I'll phone his office, and if he's not there, I'll phone his home. Bigger heard their footsteps dying away. A door slammed. And then, all was quiet. He came out of the closet and looked in the dresser drawer where he had put the pamphlets. Yes, Britton had searched his room. His clothes were mussed and tumbled. He would know how to handle Britton next time. Britton was familiar to him. He had met 1,000 Britons in his life. He stood in the center of the room, thinking. When Britton questioned Jan, would Jan deny having been with Mary at all, in order to protect her? If he did, that would be in his favor. If Britton wanted to check his story about Mary's not going to school last night, he could. If Jan said that they had not been drinking, it could be proved that they had been drinking by folks in the cafe. If Jan lied about one thing, it would be readily believed that he would lie about others. If Jan said that he had not come to the house, who would believe him after it was seen that he had lied about his not drinking and about Mary's going to school? If Jan tried to protect Mary, as he thought he would only succeed in making a case against himself. Bigger went to the window and looked out at the white curtain of falling snow. He thought of the kidnap note. Should he try to get the money from them now? Hell yes. He would show that Britton bastard. He would work fast. But he would wait until after Jan had told his story. He should see Bessie tonight. And he ought to pick out the pencil and paper he would use. And he must not forget to use gloves when he wrote the note, so that no fingerprints would be on the paper. He'd give that Britton something to worry about, all right. Just wait. Because he could go now, run off if he wanted to, and leave it all behind, he felt a certain sense of power, a power born of a latent capacity to live. He was conscious of this quiet, warm, clean, rich house, this room with this bed so soft, the wealthy white people moving in luxury to all sides of him, whites living in a smugness, a security, a certainty that he had never known. The knowledge that he had killed a white girl they loved, and regarded as their symbol of beauty, made him feel the equal of them, like a man who had been somehow cheated, but had now evened the score. The more the sense of Britton seeped into him, the more did he feel the need to face him once again, and let him try to get something from him. Next time he would do better. He had let Britton trap him on that communist business. He should have been on the lookout for that. But the lucky thing was that he knew that Britton had done all his tricks at once, had shot his bolt, had played all his cards. Now that the thing was out in the open, he would know how to act. And furthermore, Britton might want him as a witness against Jan. He smiled while he lay in the darkness. If that happened, he would be safe in sending the ransom note. He could send it just when they thought they had pinned the disappearance of Mary upon Jan. That would throw everything into confusion, and would make them want to reply and give the money at once and save the girl. The warm room lulled his blood, and a deepening sense of fatigue drugged him with sleep. He stretched out more fully on the bed, sighed, turned on his back, swallowed, and closed his eyes. Out of the surrounding silence and darkness came the quiet ringing of a distant church bell, thin, faint, but clear. It tolled, soft, then loud, then still louder, so loud that he wondered where it was. It sounded suddenly directly above his head, and when he looked it was not there, but went on tolling, and with each passing moment he felt an urgent need to run and hide, as though the bell were sounding a warning. And he stood on a street corner in a red glare of light, like that which came from the furnace. And he had a big package in his arms, so wet and slippery and heavy that he could scarcely hold on to it. And he wanted to know what was in the package, and he stopped near an alley corner and unwrapped it, and the paper fell away, and he saw it was his own head. His own head lying with black face and half-closed eyes and lips parted with white teeth showing and hair wet with blood. And the red glare grew brighter, like light shining down from a red moon and red stars on a hot summer night, and he was sweating and breathless from running, and the bell clanged so loud that he could hear the iron tongue clapping against the metal sides each time it swung to and fro,
and he was running over a street paved with black coal, and his shoes kicked tiny lumps rattling against tin cans, and he knew that very soon he had to find some place to hide, but there was no place, and in front of him white people were coming to ask about the head from which the newspapers had fallen, and which was now slippery with blood in his naked hands, and he gave up and stood in the middle of the street in the red darkness, and cursed the booming bell and the white people, and felt that he did not give a damn what happened to him, and when the people closed in he hurled the bloody head squarely into their faces. Dong, dong, dong. He opened his eyes and looked about him in the darkened room, hearing a bell ring. He sat up. The bell sounded again. How long had it been ringing? He got to his feet, swaying from stiffness, trying to shake off sleep and that awful dream. Yosem, he mumbled. The bell rang again, insistently. He fumbled in the dark for the light chain and pulled it. Excitement quickened within him. Had something happened? Was this the police?
Bigger!
A muffled voice called.
Yes, sir.
He braced himself for whatever was coming and stepped to the door. As he opened it, he felt it being pushed in by someone who seemed determined to get in a hurry. Bigger backed away, blinking his eyes.
We want to talk to you, said Britton.
Yes, sir.
He did not hear what Britton said after that, for he saw, directly behind Britton, a face that made him hold his breath. It was not fear, he felt, but attention, a supreme gathering of all the forces of his body for a showdown.
Go on in, Mr. Erlone, Mr. Dalton said.
Bigger saw Jan's eyes looking at him steadily. Jan stepped into the room, and Mr. Dalton followed. Bigger stood with his lips slightly parted, his hands hanging loosely by his sides, his eyes watchful, but veiled.
Sit down, Erlone, Britton said.
This is all right, Jan said. I'll stand.
Bigger saw Britton pull from his coat pocket the packet of pamphlets and hold them under Jan's eyes. Jan's lips twisted into a faint smile.
Well, Jan said. You're one of those tough Reds, huh? Britton asked.
Come on, let's get this over with, Jan said.
What do you want?
Take it easy, Britton said.
You got plenty of time. I know your kind. You like to rush and have things your way.
Bigger saw Mr. Dalton standing to one side, looking anxiously from one to the other. Several times Mr. Dalton made as if to say something, then checked himself.